Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Well, welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and again, we're going to be talking about the Kingdom of God, and we're in a study of Genesis, and we're up to chapter 46. We were going through chapter 45, and that was, of course, Joseph revealing himself to his brothers that he wasn't dead, and that he was extremely powerful in Egypt, and that he forgave them. And we know that forgiveness began back probably almost immediately. This is one of the things about forgiveness. And forgiveness is a very important aspect of the kingdom of God, because Christ kept repeating this over and over again, how important forgiveness. If you even want to be forgiven, you have to be forgiving others. And it's amazing how many people who call themselves Christians or followers of Moses, and they're not very good at forgiving. Even their own family members, who did a lot less than what we see done to Joseph. Joseph was beat up, threatened with death, thrown into a pit. Some of the brothers kind of wanted to get him out of the pit, but the others had sold him into bondage. And the reality is we're all a little bit in that bondage today, in a pit of bondage. And we get in that pit of bondage out of the same process of envy and jealousy, and also the way in which we deal with that envy and jealousy. And I always point out that if the brothers had killed Joseph, and of course Reuben, you know, pleads that don't kill the boy. Important safety tip. If you actually cause the death of your neighbor or your brother in humanity, that creates a repercussion, a consequence. It brings a wrath of God that, and a recompense that is not easily dealt with. They fortunately did not kill him, and because they did not kill him, he was able to perform a particular function. Now, in my perspective of how God works, God is outside. He's the unmoved mover. He's not moved by your decisions. He's not moved by your praise. He's not moved by your desires or your hate and contempt. You can't really make God sad. You can create a sort of divine karma that will pursue you, because like ripples, you know, if you throw a rock in a pond or you throw a rock in a swimming pool and it creates ripples that go across the water, eventually those ripples will bounce back towards you. You know, what goes around comes around. And in this quantum spiritual realm, the actions you manifest will come back and haunt you as an individual. They will come back and affect you as an individual. It's built in. It doesn't affect God. You are not the God of God. You cannot upset God. You can't really make God happy. We use terms like that because those terms are so common to us in our relationships with other people. But our relationship with God is divine. It's infinite. It's not finite like we are, because God is not finite. Whatever God is, He's not finite. He's the unmoved mover. By mover, they mean He has moved creation into existence. What we call the created. The things that we see as created. The things that we see as things. And scientists want to look at the product and disregard the cause of the product. You know, they want to figure out the design, but they deny the designer. And it's interesting, there's like an awakening going on in the world today. And that awakening is a very interesting process that we can stand back and watch, kind of like what we see in the media going on in governments around the world and the interaction of the leaders of those governments. Leaders of governments are not the governments themselves. They're not the nations themselves. They represent the nations, and they can affect the course of the nation. But if there is a God, the people themselves design their leaders. They draw their leaders into positions of power over them by the nature of the people. And of course, the nature of the people is not singular. The nature of the people is somewhat like a soup. There could be all kinds of good ingredients in the soup, you know, vegetables and meat, and that creates broth that interacts with the fats and the vitamins that are in there. The heat of the soup is going to change the nature of the soup. How much you boil it, how much, you know, how hot it gets, the seasonings that you put in there. But eventually the soup is the soup. And if you put poison mushrooms in the soup, then even if a person doesn't eat the poison mushrooms, he may be affected by the poison that is in the soup, because the poison may come out and interlace itself with the soup. It may kill him. It may just make him sick. Maybe if he eats one of the pieces, you know, kind of like a bay leaf. And you know, the first time I remember as a young kid, I got the bay leaf and the sauce. And I thought, like, what is this? Somebody put a leaf in my spaghetti sauce. Well, it was part of the seasoning, and you don't necessarily have to eat the bay leaf. But the reality is that that's what we're doing with humanity, is there's a lot of us. And we're all there. But should we be in this soup itself? And of course, we've talked many times about the cauldron that they talk about in the Bible. And of course, it's full of metaphors. More and more, I see the many articles that we've written. And we have one on the cauldron, and an article on one purse, and we have an article on snares and traps and covetous practices and leaven. And we're actually going to see how they bring up this idea of leaven, but they don't translate it leaven, because the same word for leaven is also a word for oppression in the Hebrew. It's the same letters. And of course, now, basic Hebrew words are three letters long, but the basic letter for oppression is often four or five or six letters long. Just as there's a basic word for life, but to say preserve life, you know, now you'll have extra letters. And we'll see, well, we did look at that in Genesis 45. We saw how this word, that God's plan was to preserve the life of the people. Not just the individuals, his brothers, you know, which are Asher and Issachar and Reuben and all these different brothers, but their posterity, their children. And we are their children. They've come down, you know, those people were thousands of years ago. There was Babylonian captivity. Some came back. Some went north. They lost their identity. They mixed in with other people. All those people are mixed in all over the world now. But they're also a microcosm of humanity itself. God did not pick the chosen people because they were the best, but often because they were stiff-necked. he chose them because of that quality. Not because that quality is good, but because that quality will allow them to explore every possible mistake you can make as a society. And they were, by their actions, good and bad, will be priests to all nations. If we read the book as if the book has its own message about humanity, about mankind, about the nature of mankind. You can go all the way back to Genesis 1 and you know, the story of Adam and Eve. You know, and the tree of knowledge and the tree of life. There's these two trees, both given to us as a gift. But the use of one is not the same as the use of the other. You are not to use the tree of knowledge as a source of life. You are to use the tree of life as a source of life, as your guidance. If you took the tree of knowledge and you tried to use it to decide what was good and evil for yourself, it would create a whole chain of consequences. Like those ripples in the water that will go out and come back and affect you because you're in the water now. You're a part of the world. And when you alter the world, you will be altered by the world. But if you eat of the tree of life, eat of the Holy Spirit, you can overcome the world. And the effects of the previous generation's use of the tree of knowledge, which is requires a certain vanity where you're going to figure it out without this divine spark connection to God, this inner revelation that men can have or be gifted if they follow the ways of God. If you cut yourself off on the ways of God with things like unforgiveness, cruelty, denial. The brothers didn't want to think, you know, that we don't see much of a conversation anywhere. There is some reference to that. If they go back to Egypt, did they think, well, we might run into Joseph? But they actually believed that Joseph would have been dead. Many years had passed. And he was sold as a slave. They had nothing in their imagination that would make them think that Joseph would have rose to the position that he rose to. They held their brother in contempt, or at least were jealous. They all were a little jealous and envious of him. And yet we see both Jacob favoring Joseph. He couldn't seem to help favor Joseph and Benjamin. And of course, Joseph certainly favored Benjamin. But he cared about his other brothers too, and he had learned to forgive them when he started having children of his own. It changed him. That's something I point out to many people, that when you have children, it changes you. It alters you. But you don't necessarily have to be the father of a child or the mother of a child to be changed by the mere presence of a child. You could be an aunt or an uncle. You could be a friend of somebody who has a child and care about that child as much as you would care about your own. You can actually do that. And young girls, you know, they hear a baby crying. And it can awaken things in them. Just hearing the baby crying without going through the process of birth. And that is one of the mysteries of compassion, which is another one of those characters. Some of the brothers show compassion. They didn't have much when they threw Joseph into the pit. But later on, we see Judah manifesting this compassion, at least for his father, on behalf of Benjamin. offering himself, sacrificing himself, like Christ sacrificed himself for that the whole world might be saved. Judah was willing to sacrifice himself so that his father might be saved from the pain and agony of losing Benjamin. And this is showing us a characteristic that we should want to cultivate in our own hearts and our own minds. This forgiveness of Joseph for his brothers is very important for us all to learn. And again, like I say, Israel made all the mistakes you could make. The brothers were making all the mistakes you could make. Jacob made mistakes. Went the wrong way. He grabbed his brother's heel. He wrestled with the heel of the message of the messenger that he wrestled with. And we'll get into that more when we go back and study the earlier in Genesis when Jacob became Israel. And we'll give you bits and pieces of this so that you begin to understand what it means to be Israel. Because Jacob didn't know what it meant to be Israel until he had this wrestling match with the message. It wasn't with the messenger. It was with the message. And there was pain and agony and sacrifice in that process that led him to win out, which involved the grasping of a heel, but he had grasped the heel of his brother, Esau. Should Jacob have become the heir to Isaac? Why didn't Esau become Israel? Well, Esau did learn something. He forgave his brother. At first he didn't want to forgive him. At first he wanted to kill him. And what happened? I mean, like, we'll just briefly look at this story. Esau was being born first, supposedly. His hand came out of the womb. And they tied this thread around it to show that he's the firstborn, but his head wasn't out. And then he supposedly gets pulled back in, as suggested by Jacob. And Jacob is born first. But Jacob doesn't have the thread around his arm, so he's not going to become the heir. He's not the firstborn. But he is the firstborn. But their way of calculating the firstborn was not really accurate. Because you're not really born until the head comes out. So, anyway, kind of bizarre. Rough pregnancy. We just had somebody in the network. Just had twins. They had to actually leave the state that they were living in to have the twins in another state because they wanted to have a natural birth and they were going to be forced to go to a hospital by laws that just changed in the state. But they were able to, and it actually all worked out. It seems like it was a very short labor compared to what it must have been for Rachel. But these are all part of God's plan. Things that happen are part of God's plan, and we either learn from them or we don't. And Jacob was born. Later on, Jacob buys the birthright, which Esau doesn't really hold in much value. Now we're led to believe that there was another bowl of soup, you know, a pot of porridge, that he sold his birthright for. Well, it may have been a lot more than that. Because these weren't just individuals running around. They they were wealthy. They had lots of people that were a part of their households. And they were prominent in those areas. We kind of draw this picture from limited text. And we have to be careful that we do not limit what is really there. They gave us the essential facts. But Esau sold his birthright for provisions. And that's what many people do. During the Depression of the 30s in the United States, people literally sold a portion of their birthright to obtain benefits, a portion of their labor to obtain benefits from men who exercised authority. And they didn't even see the biblical ramifications. Some did. I actually know of ministers who spoke out against it. And their children, some of them, went along with it, but one didn't for many, many years. And that's a fascinating story in itself. But the reality is that these processes go on all the time, and Jesus talks about it. And certainly Paul talks about it. Through covetous practices, Peter says, you'll be made merchandise. And what is that covet? Desiring that pot of porridge. But not just any pot of porridge. A pot of porridge at the expense of others. Which it takes us back to that cauldron. That pot of porridge is a source of our provisions. When it says Nimrod is a mighty hunter before the Lord, but what it's actually saying is Nimrod is a mighty provider instead of the Lord. And that gives it a different meaning. Now, you could certainly say it the other way once you understand the multiple meaning of the words that are in the context, which we bring up a lot of times and show you example after example after example. Just like the word preserve life in that verse 5 of chapter 45. It talks about a word that has to do with the preservation of life. And it is actually translated victuals. Well, that word that we see, Nimrod is a mighty hunter before the Lord, is a word that is also most often translated victuals, venison, provisions for life. But when we look in that verse 5, we don't see Mika, we see a word that begins with Lamad. Ends with hay. But anyway, we'll talk more about this and other things in this chapter 46, which we're going to cover in a moment after this break. Well, welcome back. So, in that chapter 45, again, this is where Joseph tells his brothers that he forgives them. He pours gifts upon them. Yeah, extra to Benjamin again, which is very important to understand in the kingdom of God. There are extra things given to some men and not given to others. Each of the portion that we get, we have to do well with it. Even Jesus has parables about, you know, the guy who was given one talent, the guy who was given two talents, and the guy who was given three talents. I may have those numbers wrong, but they were given more. Some were given more. And the one who did well with what he was given more again. And the one who did nothing with what he was given, it was taken away. This is a characteristic of the kingdom. You can be given some things and not given others. And you should not be jealous and envious of those who are given more. Because with more comes often more responsibilities. more coal for sacrifice. And of course, Joseph went through a lot of difficulties when he was in Egypt, thrown back into prison. And life was in danger. But he continued to be of service. So if you're born in one country, like the Ukraine, you're going to have different difficulties than if you were born in Canada. And if you were born in Venezuela, you're having different difficulties than if you were born in Alabama or Oregon. And this is just the way things are handled in the universe. You know, one side of the planet's going to get sun and the other side is going to be in the dark. And one side is going to have winter and the other is going to have summer. Summer comes with its difficulties. Winter comes with its difficulties. But you are only in these places in the moment. Do well with what you have. And according to what we see in many of the stories, if you do well with what you have, more will be given to you. But if you don't do well with what you have, if you become resentful, I saw supposedly a father gave his young son a toy car. I mean, it's a little, you know, I mean, it was big, but it was some sort of plastic toy car, and the kid didn't like it and kicked it. And the father reaches down and carries it up the stairs and throws it off the balcony and breaks pieces off of it. And of course the kid is trying to stop him, but he didn't show the appreciation. And this is one of the things that we see amongst the Essenes. We see it in numerous of the prophets of the Bible, that they thank God for their difficulties. They accept, not only accept the difficulty, but they thank God for their difficulties. Now, that is really important to understand the principle of that, not just in your head, because that's the tree of knowledge, but in your heart. Because that's how you love your neighbor, even though, or love your enemy. Even though your enemy may do something you don't like, it may be even a bad thing. If you hate him, then a seed of what he is will be planted in you. If you forgive him, then you become immune to his narcissism, his abuse. But if you hate him, if you judge him, you will bring part of his identity into you. Because you're literally, hate is a form of, almost a form of worship. In one sense it is. This is why you see when evil degrades itself deeper and deeper into the pit of darkness, that it will actually not only consume its neighbor, but consume its next generation. And that is actually taking place for years now in many countries, where the people want benefits today and they leave the bill for their children. Of course, that's another thing that covetous practices do in the universe, is that they curse your children. They curse the next generation. The kingdom of God is from generation to generation. You should not be cursing the next generation with the debts you were not willing to pay, because you wanted to borrow against the future of your children so that you could have comfort today. And that's why when we go back to that idea of the cauldron, it says, let us build us a city, a governmental system, a civil law system. That's what the cauldron is. And we will be the flesh in that cauldron, in that pot, the flesh pot. And of course, artists have drawn pictures of people eating each other in the flesh pots, devouring each other, the cannibalizing each other. And eventually this brings you down and degrades the very soul so you can't even see the light. It draws you into the pit. But of course you have to forgive yourself for being in that cauldron. It may not even be your fault you're in that cauldron, at least no immediate fault. But you have to forgive that and rise above the nature of the cauldron, which is a covetous practice where people not only eat blood, but they eat meat with blood in it, and they suffocate one another with overbearing burdens of debt. And now when, you know, one government is trying to get out of debt, because some people see a value in getting out of debt, just practically speaking, at least. I don't know how deeply they hold this. People complain. People object. People cry out, but I might lose my benefits. I might lose my comfort. They don't think about sacrificing themselves for others. They want others to sacrifice themselves for them. So what happens to a society that wants to force the sacrifices of their neighbors so that they can be comforted? So they can have free stuff. So that they don't have to pay for something like education or whatever. Healthcare. I don't have to take care of my parents. The government will do it. That's what the Pharisees were doing at the time of Christ. With the help of the civil government of Herod, they set up a system of Corban sacrifice. That's what Corban means. That was making the word of God did not affect. It was a system of a social safety net system, a flesh pot of civil law where people had to pay in to take care of the needy of their society. And of course, Christ was absolutely adamantly opposed to that, said he was going to take the kingdom away from the people of Judea who thought they were Israel, and give it to another who would bear fruit. Because covetous practices only bear the fruit of bondage. They don't bear the fruit of liberty. That's why even the pagans, Plutarch said, the greatest destroyers of liberty are those who spread amongst the people gifts, gratuities, and benefits, usually at the expense of somebody else. This is a basic principle of creation. And this basic principle of creation actually goes all the way down to the cellular level of every individual, where you will be devouring your own self. Cells in your body will become what we call cancerous. And they will devour you for its own benefit. Parasites will come into you and find a home place because you're a parasite. Now there's real physical parasites out there that you could be infested with, but your vulnerability to them may be linked to the fact that you have the nature of a parasite yourself. So when we read in 45, where they talk about fall not out of the way, and of course Christianity was called the way, what are they talking about? Now, we're going to see that everybody, Israel, the sons of Jacob, which we're calling Israel, they're not really Israel yet, but they will be the prodigy that produces what will eventually become Israel. But not because of a bloodline, but because they're going to learn the lessons of Joseph. But they are going into the bondage of Egypt. And so, as we read last time when we went through 45 and verse 24, it says, "So he sent his brethren away, and they departed. And he said unto them, See that ye fall not out of the way." And they went up out of Egypt and came into the land of Canaan unto Jacob, their father, and told him, saying, Joseph is yet alive, and he is the governor of over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart fainted, and he even believed not. He believed them not. He couldn't believe this, because he had become resigned to the fact that Joseph was dead. I heard a number of biologists talking about a new idea that contradicts evolution. And it's becoming very popular. Thousands and thousands of scientists are now looking at this. That the theory of evolution as presented doesn't match up with what they're observing. That creation is not simply DNA driven. That there's a purpose in the coding. There's a purpose way down on the cellular level. And so when we talk about the kingdom of God, there is a much deeper meaning. You can't just learn the definition, find out that leaven isn't just about yeast. You can't just find out that breeches isn't about underwear. You can't just find out that the altars of clay and stone aren't about piles of rocks that you burn up sheep on. And the burning up of sheep doesn't have anything to do with burning up sheep. And giving the kidneys to the Levite has nothing to do with giving kidneys to the Levite. And you go read our articles. That's all these theologies and all these doctrines are the product of sophistry. They didn't change the meaning of words. They selected the meaning of words, because in Hebrew, all the words have multiple meanings. We may come across that today. But, he told them, saying, Joseph is alive. And he couldn't believe it. And they told him all the words of Joseph. And he saw the wagons with Joseph had sent with them to carry him. The spirit of Jacob, the father, revived, and Israel said, it is enough, Joseph, my son, is yet alive. I will go and see him before I die. Which brings us to the next chapter, which starts right away with, and Israel took his journey. Was Jacob, now they're calling him Israel. And of course, why was Jacob called Israel? That is going to be a revelation. I hope and pray that people begin to see it already before we show you the details of that. But it says, and Israel, who was Jacob but is now Israel, took his journey, not their journey, his journey with all that he had. With all that he had. He's taking everything. Now, he's not taking the trees. the date trees. Or the pomegranate bushes. Although he might be taking cuttings. Who knows. And came to Beersheba. And offered sacrifice unto God. Of his father Isaac. Now again, Jacob was... He even deceived his father, saying, I am Esau, give me the blessing. And the father gave him the blessing. Now, you would think this null and voids the contract, the agreement, because you misrepresented yourself and depended on the blindness of Isaac to get a position that God may have wanted you to have, but technically speaking, you did not have yet. See, Jesus was rightfully the king of Judea and all of Israel, all the remnant of Israel. But his purpose was to set the captive free, to return every man to his possessions and every man to his family. He was going to do what Rehoboam should have done years before when Rehoboam says, my father whipped you with whips, I shall whip you with scorpions. You cannot really set a man halfway free. You have to set them all the way free. But Jesus told us how the kingdom worked. He told us how we could seek that kingdom, sit down in the tens, hundreds, and thousands, love your neighbor as yourself, live by faith, hope, and charity, and stop living by force, fear, and fealty. The sons of Jacob were going into fealty, and they were bringing Jacob back. But Jacob didn't care about the gifts. He said, it is enough that my son is alive. I'm going to go. But before he goes to Beersheba, it says. Is Beersheba a place? Is that a town? Well, eventually it will be a town. But it means the well of sevenfold oath. I mean, that's technically what it means. It actually comes from a couple of different words. Which is the word well and the word seven. And of course, we can go back and study the whole story of Beersheba and what went on there. There was a guy, Abimelech, who had this deal where he wanted to settle something in this wilderness, because Beersheba was a wilderness, as yet his region had no name, yet as we see in Genesis 21:31, you can go read that, and it wasn't a nation, it wasn't a government, it lay about 20 Roman miles or more below Hebron, and was the most southerly part of Palestine, and it was beyond the vast lay in the vast deserts of Etir is the name that we see there. And what was going on there in this place? Well, there was Abraham was there. And Abimelech was there. And there was a claim that certain people were stealing the use of a well. And Abimelech wanted to make a deal with Abraham. And one of the things, Abraham was faced with the same dilemma of being absolutely honest. Even when he went to buy a grave, he wanted to pay for it. The guy who was going to give him the land for the grave wanted to just give it to him. No, he said, no, I got to pay for it. And so he had this dealing with Abimelech, and we're not going to go, and it wasn't just Abimelech, but also his general. And we won't go into all the details of it. But that's where Beersheba was, this agreement. And so when we go back and we see that Jacob goes to this place of Beersheba, and offered a sacrifice, or offered sacrifices unto God of his father Isaac. Remember when the sons of Jacob did a terrible thing and made Jacob stink? That's what it says in the Bible. Made him stink with the people round about him. He built an altar. And now he's making an offering at Beersheba. And actually the word offering there is zebach, which means to sacrifice, to let blood, to give up something. He's traveling with all of his possessions. And he makes a sacrifice with some of those possessions, which is the result of his whole life, 21 years working for Laban and raising his family and trying to do right with God, and including his wrestling match with the message, which we'll see later. that makes him Israel. He takes some of that and he sacrifices it. And we see this same idea of sacrificing, offering, a sacrifice of righteousness, a free will sacrifice. It's always very important to understand that you're dealing with a free will sacrifice. That, because that's what Moses is going to tell them when he brings them out of that bondage, that all their sacrifices have to be free will sacrifices. Now, the two words that we see there, offering, sacrifice, they're both spelled the same way, Zayin, Bet, Chet. But they're given different Strong's numbers. They're seen as different words. So why is that? One is the verb, and the other one is said to be a noun. So it was the act and the thing that was given up, and that both of them are basically the same words as a root word. And why is he doing that? He's going to go back and take care of the process of going back and seeing his son that's alive and now ruler of all of Egypt. There's a lot going on then, but they only give us a few lines here. But he sacrifices unto the God of his father Isaac, which means that it has to be a free will sacrifice. And it's going to somebody. And it's based on this supposed place, if that's really where they're at. And God spake unto Israel in a vision of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob, repeating it, but calling him Jacob. And he said, here am I. You could almost translate that. Well, you can translate that. Here I am. This is the I am. And he said, I am, again, I am God, God of thy father. Fear not, go down to Egypt. So what would have been the fear? His son is running all of Egypt. He's going down there. Well, Egypt's offerings are not all free will. In many ways, they're pagan. In many ways, they're different than them. See, that's one of the main differences between the pagan and the ways of God. The way of God is that you take care of all the needy through free will offerings. Always through free will offerings. Never through forced offerings. Forced offerings makes the word of God to none effect. Free will offerings allows you to draw near to God. That's what Corbin comes from, a word to draw near. But if your Corbin becomes a forced offering, you're not going to draw near. You're actually going to make the word of God to none effect. So he says, fear not to go down into Egypt. Well, Egypt is a word that means slavery. That's what it means. It's the bondage of Egypt. Fear not going down into bondage. Now, they're not necessarily going down into bondage yet, but we're going to see this process because the famine's not over. There's going to be a lot of famine. And there's only one group that doesn't go into bondage in Egypt. And it doesn't say that is the sons of Jacob. But the priests are the only ones who don't go into bondage. And there's a reason for that. We'll cover that when we get to it. He says, but don't fear going down into this land of bondage, for I will there make of thee a great nation. So the hardships that they're going to suffer in Egypt is a part of God's plan. It's not going to be hard at first, but it eventually will turn hard. But that, just like Joseph's game with his brothers, there's a purpose to awaken something in you. And you should thank God for your difficulties. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. So this idea of going to Beersheba, again, it's from two words, well and seven. Seven, actually, the same word for seven is also the same word for satisfy. And, of course, a well is a source of water. So to that well of satisfaction is where he goes to make this offering. When he was worried about himself stinking, he created an altar. This because sacrifice is what brings that satisfaction. It also connects us with a well of water. Christ has many parables. You know, the woman at the well. I am the water that you will not thirst again. So Beersheba, this reference to the sacrifice at Beersheba is not a reference to a particular location where he piled up a bunch of rocks and he sacrificed to. It's about seeking the sacrifice, the free will offerings of God. Repeating that word as a verb and a noun, this zabak of, and then we can look at, you know, Zayin, Aleph, Chet, and also look at the extra letters that are sometimes found in these verses, telling you what it's about, the extra mems, this flow of water, this flow of the tree of life is what they're ultimately looking for. And the I Am is trying to lead you back to that tree of life. And you will still have the tree of knowledge. You may have knowledge, but you won't depend upon your own vanity and knowledge to figure out what is good and evil. So he says, after this vision and this statement that he will make him a great nation, he says, I will go down with thee into Egypt. So God will go down with them into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again. So this is the promise that Moses is going to come and bring them out of Egypt. But hopefully they will learn some lessons and remember those lessons, but eventually they will forget those again. Some will. Everybody didn't necessarily forget those lessons. It's a process. But he'll bring him up again, and he says, and Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes, so that Jacob will see even more before he's done. And then he will give blessings to his sons. And it says, and Jacob rose up from this well of satisfaction, Beersheba, this well of satisfaction that comes when we offer sacrifices out of love. That's what they're saying. That's really, when you read the Hebrew letters in a row, that's what he's saying. This well of satisfaction, this willingness to make an offering and a sacrifice of yourself, not of others, but of yourself. And then it says, and the sons of Israel carried Jacob their father. So again, they refer to the sons of Israel. They are not Israel yet. They have to go into bondage for 400 years, suffer, and, you know, the journey with Moses in order to become Israel. And everybody won't become Israel. But they will call them Israel. Because some will. Some will not be afraid. Some will walk in faith, not in fear. Some will walk in unselfishness. Others will be selfish. But they will be called Israel because they will have learned the lessons that Jacob learned back there when he wrestled with the message. So, the sons of Israel carried Jacob, their father, and their little ones, and their wives, in the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. And they took their cattle and their goods, which they had gotten in the land of Canaan. and came into Egypt, Jacob and all his seed with him. His sons' sons with him, his daughters and his sons' daughters, and all his seed brought he with him into Egypt, into the land of bondage. And now it talks about those sons. And there's a lot to these sons. I've always wanted to do a detailed study of the sons. I've started going back to it. I've studied them in the past. I've talked to other people who I see as, you know, prophets in their own rights. They're not big and famous or anything. They were lowly men, and very few people wanted to hear them. But a portion of their life, because of their own struggles, their own ripples they had laid out in the water and received the consequences of, they began to see certain things. I find it fascinating as people begin to have their eyes open and their ears open. And this is a major theme throughout the Bible. If you will not see the trials and tribulations of your brother, if you will not hear the cries of your brother, God will not hear you either. So hard times are necessary. But in verse 8 it says, "And these are the names of the children of Israel, which came into Egypt, into that bondage, Jacob and his sons. Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, and the sons of Reuben, Hanok, Phallu, and Hezron, and Carmi." Verse 10, "And the sons of Simeon, Jemuel, Jamin, Ohad, Jachin, Zohar, Shaul, the sons of the Canaanite woman. And the sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, Merari." So all these people are coming. All of them will have different characteristics. We can learn about different ones. Levi and Judah. The son of Judah's are Er, Onan, Shelah, Perez, and Zerah. Lots of sons. And they're going to all be in bondage for 400 years. But Er and Onan died in the land of Canaan. And the sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul. So we're seeing these people from generation to generation coming down to us through the history of Israel. But they're actually representative in many ways, that we don't have books about all the details of different parts of their lives. But we do know a lot about, you know, Judah and Issachar, Levi, and it says the son of Issachar are Tola and Fuva and Job and Shimron. And the sons of Zebulun, Sered and Elon and Jaleel. And the sons of Leah, and these be the sons of Leah, she bare unto Jacob in Padanaram. Which, even that word has a meaning. We won't go into it. We don't have the time to go into it right now. Along with the daughter of Dinah. The daughter Dinah. All the souls of his sons and his daughters were 33. And the sons of God, Ziphion and Haggi, Shuni and Ezbon, Eri and Erodi and Areli. So they're having lots and lots of kids. All this is coming down from Isaac, who just had Esau and Jacob, pretty much. And then there's the sons of Asher, Jibnah, Ishua, and Isui, and Berea, and Sarah, their sister. And the sons of Berea, Heber and Malkiel. And they are the sons of Zilpah, whom Laban gave to Leah, his daughter, and these she bare unto Jacob, even 16 souls. So, he originally only wanted to add this conversation with somebody just the other day, is that yes, because they're adamant, and this is absolutely true. It's, you know, somebody who said there's no penalty for having more than one wife. And I said, yeah, there is. The penalty for having more than one wife is having more than one wife. Because always in the Bible, trouble comes from it. But to be fair with Jacob, he only wanted the one wife. He only wanted Rachel. And yet he was tricked by Laban. And God can turn it to good if you continue to serve God. But Jacob didn't know how to serve God. He didn't know how to pray at the well of satisfaction and sacrifice at the well of satisfaction. He didn't know how to trust in God. He thought through the power of his own arm, he could bring about his destiny. And he was willing to hold his brother back so that he could obtain his destiny. No. That he's not going to be Israel as long as he thinks that way. If you think you can oppress your brother or your cousin or sell your cousin into bondage or ship your cousin off out of the way so that you may have your way, this will be a ripple that will come back and haunt you and will keep you from becoming Israel. And Jacob had to learn that lesson. And Jacob was learning it. Even when he knew he was headed down to Egypt, he stops at the well of satisfaction and makes a sacrifice. And of course, in reality, he probably made sacrifices all the time when he met people and along the way. He's going with all his possessions. He's helping people who might show a need, and he's trying to listen to the I Am as to when to give and when not to give. But he's not holding his brother's heel back. And this is what brought, they talk about his thigh being out of joint. It's not his thigh. It's his generations are going to be out of joint. This is why his sons were doing all the things that they were doing that were contrary to what Jacob wanted and was making Jacob stink. Because Jacob goes all the way back to when Jacob tried to hold his brother back so that he could get what he thought he had a right to. That is contrary to the ways of Israel. You can't be Israel and be oppressive. You have to get the leaven out of Israel. You have to get, wherever Israel is today, they need to get the leaven out of their well, or there will be no satisfaction. So we see these different sons, like the son of Gad, are Siphion, Haggai, Shuni, Esbon, Eri, Erodi, and Areli. Who are all these people? If we actually looked up their names, there's means connected to the letters of their name. But that's getting into more depth than we have time for today. We have this son of Asher, are Jemna, and Yeshua, and Nisui, and Berea, and Sarah, their sister. These are also, there's meanings to these names, like I say, in the same way with Zilpah, whom Laban gave to Leah, his daughter, which we kind of covered, these 16 souls. Each, if you were to go into a really, you could write a whole book, go into each of these individuals and with the help of the I Am, you will see what the characteristics of these individuals. You go up to, we'll maybe do that if we have time before the end. I think we'll have time before the end. Let's see the verse 19. He says, the sons of Rachel, Jacob's wife, because that's who he wanted to marry, are Joseph and Benjamin. Now, theoretically, he could do the whole thing with Joseph and Benjamin. But God allowed these difficulties to come upon Jacob, so that Jacob would learn certain things. And he will turn the rest of the sons into good. They won't always do good. Sometimes they'll do bad. Sometimes they will create problems. But if Jacob will learn from that, and that's what he did, he learned from that. And he wrestled. I mean, the whole idea of him wrestling with an angel, and again, like I say, you have to go to Kings and Hosea to get a better picture of this, but he is, to some degree, a personification of Christ, of what Christ will be. And Christ, like I say, Christ went off alone to pray and knew that he was going to have to face a heavy burden, crucifixion. And he would be just as happy to let that pass before him. That's the essence of his prayer. Let this cup pass before me. I don't want to really do this. But, in the final analysis, I want to do the will of the Father. And that's laying out in this conversation God has with God, Christ has with God, in his heart, in his soul, where he goes off alone and prays. This is what Jacob is doing, going off alone and praying with supplication and confronting the message that was given to him and facing that message and realizing that he had put his own thigh, his own generations out of joint, because that's the actual word there, the thigh. Has to do with the loins. Because he wasn't doing things the right way. He was trying to oppress his brother, thinking that that's how I get my inheritance, is to oppress my brother, to trick my father. And he thought with the power of his own arm, his own... We'll eventually see where there's a word inhabitants, which actually is also the word for sword. And they just translate it different ways. We'll see that in Genesis 49, I think it's verse 5. Where all these curses and blessings, because the curses are blessings, if we respond correctly, like Joseph does. He's put into a nice, comfortable house. He's given all this power and trust. And then the wife wants him to sleep with him. But he won't do it. And he gets thrown back into prison again. Because he remains faithful to what is right. And it is not right that you oppress your brother. That you have to believe that the tree of life, that God is at work in the world. And you don't need to... This is one of the things with Gad. He was supposed to be this great fighter. But it isn't violent battle that saved the Israelites from the Egyptians. They didn't have to even pick up a sword. But there were times they had to pick up a sword. So which is it? Do we have to pick up a sword or not pick up the sword? Well, the fact is if we are not truly faithful, we may have to pick up a sword. But ultimately, if we want to become what Jacob became, which they call Israel, we're confronted with a lot of different situations, and we're going to have to learn to what would Jesus do? That's a famous thing that keeps coming up. What would Jesus do? Would Jesus pick up a sword? He didn't pick up a sword. He even overcame death. But maybe we're not to that point. But if we have to pick up a sword, we should know this is not the true answer to becoming Israel. And there are many people out there that are hard-hearted, stubborn, and they're not going to see the truth. They're not going to see the way, which is make sure you do not fall out of the way. And of course, Jacob stuck to it pretty much, eventually, after the wrestling with the message. And under Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim, which Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bare unto him. So his two children became, you know, Manasseh and Ephraim, and which were literally almost tribes unto themselves, were out of a daughter of the Egyptians. And the sons of Benjamin, even Moses, married the daughter of the priest of Midian. So it's not bloodline. Never has been bloodline. It's about faith. It's about the blood in your cells. And this is what these biologists are discovering, is that you take cells out of a cadaver and you put them in a nutrient substance so they continue to live, because they were not dead yet. And they see these cells repairing other cells, you know, lung cells repairing nerve cells. Why do they all of a sudden change their purpose and begin to do that? Begin to interact with other cells. Where is the connection? Well, that's a surprising answer. And they're still just struggling with it. But there is an awakening coming amongst scientists now. But does it mean you're going to awaken? And the most important person that you need to have awakened is yourselves. And the world is going to try to say, no, go this way, go that way. The way of Christ is the ultimate answer. And Jacob has discovered this, but all his sons have not. So then they talk about the sons of Benjamin, or Bela and Becher and Eshbel and Gera and Naaman and Ahi and Rosh and Huppim and Ard. That's almost a poem. These are the sons altogether of everybody, the sons of Rachel, Joseph, and Benjamin, which are born to Jacob. All the souls were 14. Now that you would think that in writing some things that you would say, these are the sons of Rachel, of Jacob, and all their 14, and then name them. But they did it the other way in this text. And there's a reason for that. Because they're telling you, if you understand how the prophets wrote, they're telling you that all these names, all these people, are prophets. Every one of these names is prophesying something, in the sense trying to teach you something. But to go in and analyze every one, that's climbing around in the tree of knowledge. You want to be eating of the tree of life. And Christ came to tell you how to do that more clearly, in a much more modern language anyway, you know, Greek. At least the way we see it is Greek. But how you receive the Comforter is through sacrifice. Everybody wants to say, well, Jesus did it all, we don't have to do anything. No. You have to walk the way of sacrifice. It's part of the nature. You have to have a purpose of service to others. That's what religion is supposed to be. And it has to be where when you give, you're really providing a service to others, a blessing to others. Because just giving others is not necessarily going to, it may weaken them. But then it talks about the sons of Bela, the sons of Dan is Hushim, and the sons of Naphtali, Jezreel, and Gunzi, and Jezer, and Shiliam, and the sons of Bela, and which Laban gave to Rachel, his daughter, another one of those servants. So there were, ended up being at least four wives here, but they called some of them concubines. And then we can look into the word concubine to understand that. But this is how he got such a big family. But to some degree, desiring this big family is he thinks he's going to build a nation by this. But ultimately, that's still grasping the heel, trying to make it happen with your own strength. Because whatever Jacob touched, it was blessed. And those souls were seven, born unto Jacob. And all the souls came with Jacob into Egypt, which came out of his loins. That's that same word, thigh. Besides Jacob's sons' wives, the souls were 66. And the sons of Joseph, which were born him in Egypt, were 2 souls. And all the souls of the house of Jacob, which came into Egypt, were 60. And he sent Judah before him unto Joseph to direct his face unto Goshen. And they came into the land of Goshen. And Joseph made ready his chariot and went up to meet Israel, his father, to Goshen, and presented himself unto him, and he fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. And Israel said unto Joseph, Now let me die, since I have seen thy face, because thou art yet alive. We'll be right back to Keys of the Kingdom. Well, welcome back. So, all of them were going down into Egypt, and now they're even going to appear before Pharaoh. And Joseph is still telling them what to say and what to do. Joseph has an insight into the nature of the kingdom, how the difficulties that come to you, you should be thankful for. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't try to overcome those difficulties, but you should overcome them with righteousness. Very important that you... So what is righteousness? Well, of course, eventually they'll have the Ten Commandments. Of course, in Egypt, they knew the Maarot, which are the laws of Egypt. They were in existence for many, many years. Joseph knew them. And they're very much like the Ten Commandments, although there's about 60-some-odd rules. But it includes not coveting, not stealing, all these basic things. Not, you know, you don't covet your neighbor's wife. So Joseph would not sleep with his master's wife, even though she said she'd keep it a secret. I'm not going to do that, even if it means I'm going to go back to this prison and back into a hard life. He was willing to do that in order to do right by others. Jacob didn't trust that. He wanted to use the strength of his own arm to guarantee his place in this realm, this world, this universe. And he did not trust in the way of God. Not really, not fully. And then he learned to do that. But he learned to do it after he had had all these sons, which put his generations out of joint. And they were doing things that made him stink. They were throwing their own brother into bondage, selling them off as a slave, because they didn't know what Jacob had learned. They inherited the sins of their father, and many of them fell to that. And then we can, in a study of all the sons, we can see that, well, every one of them had certain problems. But in these last few chapters, we saw that Judah had this problem. We'll also see that Levi, Simeon had these problems. And they did things that released them from the bondage of those problems, those curses that have come upon them. They fell to the temptation themselves, and then they had to overcome that curse. In your life, you have characteristics. Many people do not even see their prejudice, their envy, their bias. their denial of the truth. And of course, if you deny the truth about one thing, that darkens your eyes. Joseph saw a great deal because Joseph's life was hard, and Joseph was willing to see and stay because he was the blessed son, firstborn priest in that family. And so the presence of Joseph, there are probably thousands of conversations and interactions with Joseph and Jacob when they were in Egypt. And this was all a part of where it says, he shall put his hand upon your eyes. Joseph could see things other people couldn't see. And he created this whole scenario of, you know, why is my cup in your grain bag? And I'm going to hold this one hostage till you bring the other son. And I want to see the father. And because he wants them to see. He's actually creating obstacles. Not like Joseph holding the heel of his brother, but being led by the Yod, the divine spark of revelation, and allowed him to see many, many things. So, anyway, in verse 31 it says, and Joseph said unto his brethren, and unto his father's house, the whole house, he's saying this, I will go up and show Pharaoh, and say unto him, my brethren, and my father's house, which were in the land of Canaan, are come unto me. And the men are shepherds, and their trade hath been to feed cattle. And they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. And it shall come to pass when the Pharaoh shall call you and shall say, what is your occupation? That ye shall say, thy servants, now he's telling them what to say, trade hath been about cattle from our youth even until now. Both we and also our fathers, that ye may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination unto the Egyptians. So we've mentioned this before, that the Egyptians, generally speaking, were not meat eaters. They were vegetarians, and of course they had the perfect place to grow crops because the tropical nature, and you know, it seldom snows in Cairo. but they also had these floods that came down the Nile, and they had learned to cultivate large amounts of the land. But they considered a shepherd an abomination. They looked down upon them. And so they're in Goshen to keep them somewhat separate from the Egyptians. Now, they weren't going to be entirely separate because, you know, they would have some trade goods, and eventually they would have bricks, which was a major trade item, because they could draw the clay up out of the river every year. It was always being renewed every year, and then they could make bricks, drying them in the sun, and then maybe even firing them by burning straw, and they could grow grain and all these other things that they grew, and it supplemented their income. So they did have trade with the Egyptians, but they were now going to be a part of a society where the social welfare of that Egypt, that civil government, was maintained by a 20% tax on their labor. And we'll see that in subsequent chapters. But this was for a purpose. The same as, this is probably the most important takeaway. This is same as why Joseph was going through all this antics of playing this game with his brothers. So that his brothers would have the conversation they long neglected. And Reuben saw it. This calamity has come upon us because we would not hear the cries of our brother. And eventually God will hear the cries of Israel in Egypt. Because life would get so hard, the only way they were going to make it is help one another. They didn't all help one another, but enough of them did that God heard their cries. Because they were hearing the cries of one another. They were creating a new people with the hardships as the new Pharaoh came. The hardships came upon the people of Goshen. And many of them began to rise to the occasion. Well, there are going to be hardships in your life and in the days ahead. Are you going to visit Beersheba? The well of satisfaction and sacrifice a free will offering for others to bless others even though you're in a time of difficulty. That's what they eventually had to learn in order to come out of the bondage of Egypt. So, again, like I say, all these different people, Reuben saw this early on. He saw this idea that, you know, that we see in Genesis 49:4. It's mentioned there. He says, Reuben, thou art my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, and the excellency of power, unstable as water, thou shalt not excel. This is what he's going to talk about Reuben in Genesis 49. Because thou wentest up to thy father's bed and defileth thou it. He went up to my couch. What are they talking about? Well, this was the fact that he sinned with Bila. He slept with a concubine of his father. And he, would Joseph have done that? No, Joseph wouldn't do that. So that if the society, if there are elements of society that want to break down society, they want to tell you that that's okay. That you can sleep with whoever you want. That's okay. There is no moral structure to things. There is no cheating on one another. But there is. It's because a family is a unit. It is the only unit that we see God blessing from the beginning for a long time was based on the family. That is a construction of God that people talk about male and female being a social construction. I heard somebody saying that the other day. No, it's a construction of God. Male and female. Husband and wife. Fathers and sons and fathers and daughters and mothers and sons. These are a construction of nature. But people want you to deny the God of nature. Well, when you do, you deny your natural rights. And you become a person and a thing. You become that merchandise. And they will have you engaged. They can usually only get to that point if they already previously engaged you in covetous practices. Somebody was talking about the fact that people in a certain area was innocent and other people came along and pushed them out and were cruel to them and ran them out of their homes. Well, in actuality, there are very few people that are innocent. That those that have seized control in America, that now they're supposedly trying to get rid of the corruption. Well, the corruption began when the people began to covet one another's goods. That will eventually lead to a breakdown of the family. And certainly a breakdown of the community. When the communities had to take care of the needy through free will offerings, it drew the community together. Not just drew man to the Spirit of God, but it draws a community of those who believe in the Spirit of God together. When they tell the modern Christian, you don't have to do anything, you don't have to sacrifice, you know, they're out looking to create a daily sacrifice, starting with a red heifer. And of course, as we said at the beginning, the red heifer has nothing to do with a red cow. Just like leaven has nothing to do with yeast. Just like sewing the breeches of your ministers has nothing to do with their underwear. It has to do with, well, you just go read the articles and you'll find out. But what we see is that out of jealousy and envy, the brothers were willing to sacrifice Joseph so there wouldn't be anybody over them. There wouldn't be anybody who could be blessed more than them. They thought through their own power they could take Joseph's inheritance away from him. Isn't that the sin of Jacob? And when he realized that sin, isn't that when Jacob became Israel? You cannot rise to the top on the shoulders of others. And when you create a civil society that depends on men who exercise authority one over the other to take from one class of citizen to provide for another, you open the door to a corruption that will eventually break down the family. You know, we pointed out how the black community was targeted by LBJ. We have articles that explain this, the Great Society, etc., in order to gain control over them and power over them and to buy their vote. And he very successfully did it. The black community went from Republican to Democrat. And it also went from 3% single-parent families to 60 and 70% single-parent families. Breakdown of the family. Due to what? Legal charity. Legal charity is a covetous practice. It's where you depend upon men who exercise authority to take away from your neighbor to provide you with a benefit today, even take away from the children of your future, from the product of your loins, from the generations to come. The kingdom of God is from generation to generation. So is bondage. If you're still willing to put your neighbor's children or your own children into debt and make them a surety for your debt, you will go farther and farther into bondage, farther and farther into the unrighteous mammon. But if you repent and come together as Christ intended and not be like the governments of the Gentiles who call themselves benefactors but exercise authority, but start taking care of one another with daily sacrifice. At Beersheba, at the well of satisfaction, then you will not only be changed to be like Asher, the happy one. Asher was the happy son with the proper recipe. You will be protected by God. And you will be able to go through a fiery furnace. You know, one of the words that we will, when we study the sons, one of the words that I think it's in Genesis 49:5, where it says Simeon and Levi, that was the two sons who also, there was a curse put upon them. And it's not really a curse. He's telling them what is going to happen because of things that they've chosen to do. Levi responded differently, Simeon, than Simeon. But those brethren, the instruments of cruelty are in the habitations, in their habitations. The instrument of cruelty. What's in their habitations? Cruelty. Actually, you see the word Hamas there for cruelty. That was in their habitations. That's the Hebrew word that we find actually in the text. But this instrument, what was the instrument of cruelty? It's actually a word that is translated vessel more often. And there's a scene where Jesus is in the temple and he commands, and they have a word there in the Greek that says that vessels no longer be carried in the temple. And several people say that that word actually means weapons. And this same Hebrew word that we see translated instruments in 49:5, mostly translated vessel, 166 times translated vessel, 39 times translated instrument, is also translated weapons 21 times. And even armor. But what is our armor? Isn't it the righteousness of God? And what is, when it says the instrument is Hamas, what word are they talking about there? It's actually, the word is chamak. We see supposedly the letters Hamas, but the actual word is chamak. It's written a little bit different. Chamak is chet, mem, shemak. And it's, that word is translated violence, violent, cruelty, wrong, false, but there's actually numerous words that are connected to this word. And one of them is leaven, because it has almost the same letters. You know, the root word is still there, you know, which is chamak, which is, again, normally written chet, mem, shemak, but it's, and it normally is translated like violence or violated, wrongful. But the reality is that's the leaven. That they had leaven in their household. But it's not yeast. That's why I say leaven is not about yeast. It's about cruelty. It's about oppression. If you're forcing your neighbor to contribute to your welfare through men who exercise authority, there will be injustice. And you will not be an innocent people. And, you know, if you go back to the Ottoman Empire, very difficult to study the Ottoman Empire because they wrote very little. Much of what they did write was destroyed. Very little has survived. But basically, it was a caliphate. And it was, you know, about forcing, you know, and controlling and oppressing. And it was very successful. It was one of the oldest empires. Lasted like 400 years. Because its oppression was so complete. It wasn't until World War I that it was finally destroyed. And really, in essence, it was destroyed from within because the centralization of power, centralized corruption. It's that corruption. Even in that same sentence, we're seeing this habitation, which is, yeah, at the end of that, they translated habitation. It is translated habitation because it has multiple letters in it, but it comes from a word that actually means a furnace or a forge or a smelting furnace pot. And of course, those conditions of hard times, even though you may mean that cauldron, that one purse, because you're greedy, it will become a pot boiling. And hopefully it'll boil the evil out of your own heart, the contempt out of your own heart, but only if you forgive the difficulties that are put upon you. and strive to do what is right in whatever cards that you are dealt. But it's actually the word mem, kaf, resh, hey. But when you read in the text, I believe that there are, oh yeah, it's mem, kaf, resh, tav, yod, hey, mem. Tav, yod, what is that? Yod is the divine spark, tav is faith. So whatever condition you find yourself, if you live by faith, you will find an immunity because you will find God as your protector. But until we meet again, peace on your house and may God be with you. Join us at Preparing You. Join the network. Start seeking the kingdom of God and His righteousness. Until then, God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.